Imagine this scenario. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. You are working the night shift on a really busy orthopedic floor.
The classic setting.
Right. And you have a young patient, maybe 22 years old, who just came up from the ED. He took a nasty spill on his motorcycle, ended up with a pretty bad tibia fracture.
Wait.
He's got a brand new plaster cast on his lower leg. About 30 minutes ago, you went in, you gave him his scheduled 5-E opioid because he was complaining of some discomfort, maybe a 6 out of 10.
You did your job, standard procedure.
You did your job, you charted it, you sat back down, but now the call light is going off again.
And it's not just a polite little ding, is it? It's that constant, urgent one.
Exactly. It's constant. You walk into the room and the entire vibe has completely changed. The patient is grimacing, he's sweating, he's, gripping the side rails.
And he looks you right in the eye and tells you that the pain is excruciating. It's worse than it was before you gave him the meds.
So much worse.
And he describes it as this like burning, deep, crushing pressure. Like his leg is actually exploding from the inside out.
This is the moment. This is that exact moment where the NCLEX is testing you. It's testing your ability to save a limb.
Yeah.
Your first instinct might be to think, oh, he's young. Maybe he has a low pain tolerance. Or, maybe he's drug seeking.
Or just, I need to call the doctor for a stronger dose. That's a common
A
one.
very common one. And if you follow that instinct, if you just throw more medication at the problem without really assessing what's going on, you might be missing that critical window.
A window to prevent permanent, neuromuscular damage, you are standing on the precipice of a massive medical emergency.
Right. And here's another common instinct that gets students in trouble. You see the leg is swollen. You think, okay, let me elevate that leg on a few pillows. Let's get gravity working for us, reduce that edema.
And that would be the second fatal mistake. Because what you are describing, that pain that is totally out of proportion to the injury and completely unrelieved by medication, is the hallmark sign of compartment syndrome. And if you elevate that leg, you are actually fighting against gravity in a way that reduces arterial flow to a limb that is already starving for oxygen.
You have to recognize this
We
immediately.
do.
And that is the perfect segue into what we're doing today. Welcome to ConceptCast, the audio mentor from nursingnotes.org. I'm your host, and today we are doing a very serious, very high-yield deep dive into the musculoskeletal system.
It's good to be here. And I've got to say, I love this topic. I think often when students study musculoskeletal, they think it's just about, memorizing bones or knowing the difference between a sprain and a strain.
Yeah, they think it's the easy unit.
They do. But the NCLEX doesn't really care if you can name every single carpal bone in the wrist. That's not what they're testing.
No, they don't. They care about mobility, they care about safety, and they care about those life-threatening complications that can hide in plain sight.
Exactly. We're talking about the things that can kill patients or, cause them to lose limbs. We're going to cover everything from the big bad complications like fat embolisms and compartment syndrome.
All the way to the nitty-gritty physics of traction, the really specific rules for hip replacements and amputations.
And, of course, the famous arthritis triad will break all of that down.
So the mission here is pretty simple. We want to give you those high-yield filters. When you see a musculoskeletal question on the NCLEX, we want you to be able to spot the trap, understand the safety priority, and pick the right answer with confidence.
So grab your coffee, maybe do some stretching, pun intended, and let's get into it.
Let's do it. Let's unpack this. We started with that really scary scenario of the patient in the cast, and that brings us right to our first major subtopic, the big bad complications of fractures.
Right. Fractures are common. I mean, people break bones all the time.
Sure.
But as a nurse, your priority isn't the break itself. The doctor's going to fix the break with surgery or casting. Your priority is monitoring for the complications that arise because of the break. And the biggest, scariest one, the one that keeps ortho nurses up at night, is definitely compartment syndrome.
I think we should break down the physiology here just so it really sticks. I find a lot of students memorize the definition, but they don't actually visualize what is physically happening inside that leg or that arm.
That's a great point. To really understand why this is such an emergency, you have to visualize the anatomy. Your limbs aren't just, bags of meat. They are highly organized structures. You have groups of muscles, nerves, and blood vessels, and they're all wrapped up tightly in this silvery, skin-like connective tissue called fascia.
Right, fascia. And it's incredibly strong stuff. It's designed to hold everything in place under really high stress.
Exactly. A good analogy is to think of it like the casing on a sausage. It keeps the shape, it provides structure. But here's the thing about fascia. It has a major design flaw when it comes to trauma.
Which is?
It does not stretch.
Yeah.
At all. It has zero elasticity.
So, okay, let's put that into the context of the fracture. You break your tibia. Inside that sausage casing, you now have bleeding from the bone itself and this massive inflammation from the trauma.
Then all that fluid, the blood, the edema, it all takes up space.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a normal environment, like your stomach or your neck, the skin would just stretch to accommodate that swelling.
Mm-hmm.
But inside the muscle compartment, wrapped in that super tight fascia,
mm-hmm.
that fluid has nowhere to go. So the pressure starts to rise and rise and rise, specifically within that closed compartment.
It's like wearing a pair of jeans that are three sizes too small and then trying to eat a Thanksgiving dinner.
It's actually worse than that. It's like trying to inflate a balloon inside a lead pipe. The pressure just builds and builds until eventually the pressure inside that muscle compartment becomes higher than the pressure inside your capillaries.
And this is the key concept right here. It's a battle of pressures.
Precisely. The arteries, they're high pressure, right? So they might still be able to pump blood to the area.
Yeah.
But the tiny little capillaries and veins, they're low pressure systems.
So the compartment pressure just crushes them shut.
It crushes them shut. The blood can get to the door, but it cannot get into the room.
And that's when the tissue starts to starve. That's ischemia.
And when your nerves and your muscles don't get oxygen, they die. And they die fast. We're talking irreversible neuromuscular damage within 4 to 6 hours.
Wow.
That is why the NCLEX treats this as a top-tier medical emergency.
Okay, so you absolutely have to know what this looks like. We have the famous mnemonic, the 6 P's. I feel like every nursing student has nightmares about the 6 P's.
They do.
Let's run through them, but I want you to tell me which ones are the most important for early detection.
For sure. The first one, and the most reliable early sign, is pain. But it's not just any pain. It's what we call pain out of proportion to the injury.
That's the exact phrase the test writers love to use. Pain out of proportion.
It is. If a patient broke their toe, but they are screaming like they just lost their leg, you need to pay attention. Also, pain that is completely unrelieved by opioids.
Right, like in our opening scenario.
Exactly. You gave the morphine, and they're still writhing in agony. That tells you the pain isn't coming from the broken bone itself. It's coming from the ischemia, from the tissue dying.
And specifically, pain on passive movement, right? That's a key assessment.
That is such a critical assessment technique. If you, as the nurse, gently stretch the muscle, like if you just dorsiflex their foot for them and they scream in agony, that is a huge red flag.
Because you're stretching that ischemic muscle.
You're stretching the starving muscle, and it hurts like fire.
So pain is number one. What's number two for early signs?
The second really early sign is paresthesia. That's your numbness and tingling. It's that feeling of your foot falling asleep, but it doesn't wake up. This is an early sign of nerve ischemia.
So if your patient says, hey, my toes feel kind of tingly or they feel funny, you do not ignore that.
You do not brush that off. That is a priority finding.
Okay, so pain and paresthesia are the early warning shots. What about the other piece?
The other ones are usually late signs. If you're seeing these, damage is probably already being done. Number three is pallor. The limb looks pale, maybe a little dusky because blood isn't getting there.
Okay.
Number four is poikilothermia.
That's a fancy word.
It is a very fancy word. It just means coolness. The limb takes on the temperature of the room. It feels cold to the touch, especially when you compare it to the other healthy leg.
Always compare left to right.
Always. Mm-hmm. Number five is paralysis. They can't move their toes or their fingers anymore. That means the motor nerves are dead or dying.
And then finally, number six.
Pulselessness.
And I've heard that if you wait until you can't find a pulse, it's often way too late.
That is absolutely correct. Pulselessness is a very, very late and ominous sign. Do not wait for the pulse to disappear before you call the provider. You act on the pain and the paresthesia.
Okay, so let's talk interventions. We mentioned in the intro that elevating the limb is a huge trap. I really want to circle back to that because it's so counterintuitive for us as nurses.
It really is. In almost every other area of nursing, you know, heart failure, sprains, DVTs, we elevate to reduce swelling. It's second nature.
Right.
But in compartment syndrome, you have to remember that pressure gradient we talked about. The pressure inside the leg is already sky high. If you elevate that limb above the level of the heart, you're making the heart work even harder to push blood uphill against gravity and against that massive compartment pressure.
You're basically helping the compartment syndrome win the battle.
Exactly. You are worsening the ischemia. You want to keep the extremity at heart level, not above and not below, just neutral.
And no ice either, right?
Yeah, right. Same principle. Cold, causes vasoconstriction. Vasoconstriction reduces blood flow. We need more blood flow, not less. So no ice, no elevation.
So what do? We have a patient, they have 9 out of 10 pain, their toes are tingling. What's the call?
You notify the healthcare provider immediately. This is not a watch and wait situation.
Mm-hmm.
You need to loosen any tight dressings or bandages. If there's a cast, you might need to prepare for it to be bivalved, cut in half.
And you prepare the patient for the ultimate solution, which is a fasciotomy.
Which is essentially slicing that tight sausage casing open.
It's a graphic image, but it's accurate.
It is. The surgeon makes these long incisions through the skin and the fascia to physically release that pressure. You'll actually see the muscle bulge out. Blood flow returns, and the limb is saved.
And that wound is often left open to heal, right? Because it's too swollen to close right away.
Correct. It heals by secondary intention. It's not pretty, but it saves the limb.
Okay, that is compartment syndrome. Think pressure, think pain, think paresthesia. Now let's move to the second big bad complication. This one is really sneaky because it often looks like a respiratory problem at first.
Right. We're talking about fat embolism syndrome.
This is such a classic NCLEX topic. A fat embolism usually happens with fractures of the long bones. We're talking specifically the femur, or with major hip fractures. Pelvic fractures can do it too.
Yeah.
So why long bones specifically? Why doesn't a broken finger cause a fat embolism?
It's all about what's inside the bone. The yellow marrow in the shaft of those big long bones contains a really high concentration of fat cells. When that femur snaps in half, the pressure inside the bone marrow forces globules of that fat out of the marrow and directly into the bloodstream.
So now we literally have little oil droplets floating around in the veins.
Exactly. And where do things in the veins eventually go? They travel to the right side of the heart, and then they get pumped into the lungs. These little fat globs then clog up the pulmonary capillaries, just like a blood clot would in a pulmonary embolism or a PE.
Okay, but there's a really important difference in how we spot it. If a patient has a PE from a blood clot versus a fat embolism, how do we tell them apart on an exam?
That is the million-dollar question. Because they both cause respiratory distress. You're going to see hypoxia, you'll see tachypnea, that fast breathing, shortness of breath, maybe some chest pain in both conditions.
Right.
But the fat embolism has a very distinct triad of symptoms that usually appears about 12 to 72 hours after the initial injury.
Okay, that timing is important. So it's not usually an instantaneous thing. It takes a day or two to really develop. So what's in that triad?
First, and this is often the earliest sign, is neurological changes. The fat globules can actually pass through the lungs and travel to the brain, causing microemboli.
Or it could just be the hypoxia affecting the brain first.
Exactly. Either way, you'll see confusion, restlessness, agitation, or a decreased level of consciousness, any kind of altered mental status.
So if your femur fracture patient from 2 days ago suddenly starts acting weird or doesn't know where they are, your first thought should be to check their oxygen saturation.
Yes, that's your priority. Second is the respiratory distress that we already mentioned. But the third one, this is the dead giveaway for the NCLEX, is petechiae.
Petechiae, that's that little pinpoint red rash. It looks like little red dots on the skin that don't blanch when you press on them.
Correct. And for a fat embolism, the location is very specific. You need to look for petechiae over the chest, the neck, and in the axilla, the armpit area. It can also appear in the conjunctiva of the eyes.
So why does this rash happen with fat but not with a blood clot? What's the mechanism there?
It's believed to be a reaction to the fatty acids themselves. They cause inflammation and capillary hemorrhage, basically leaky little blood vessels in the skin capillaries.
So if you see a question, it's a young man with a femur fracture who suddenly becomes confused and develops a rash on his chest.
That is a fat embolism. You pick that answer and you move on.
That is such a crucial distinction because a pulmonary embolism doesn't typically give you that chest rash.
Correct. A PE is much more about sudden collapse, sharp chest pain, and severe shortness of breath, but without the rash, and often without those early neuro changes.
Okay, so what do we do? The fat is in the blood. Can we dissolve it like we dissolve a clot?
No, unfortunately, we don't use clot busters like TPA for fat. The treatment is primarily supportive. The absolute priority is oxygen. You need to keep their O2 saturation up.
So high flow oxygen, probably a non-rebreather mask.
Exactly. High flow O2, notify the HCP immediately. You might need to give IV fluids to prevent shock. And in really severe cases, they might need to be intubated and put on a ventilator. But your main job is supporting the respiratory system while the body clears the fat.
Got it. So to recap, compartment syndrome is all about pressure and pain out of proportion. Fat embolism is confusion, respiratory distress, and that classic chest rash.
You got it. That's the core distinction.
Let's hit the third major complication before we move on to all the equipment. Infection, specifically osteomyelitis.
Ah, osteomyelitis. This is an infection inside the bone itself. This can happen from an open fracture, you know, where the bone pokes through the skin and gets exposed to bacteria from the environment.
Or it can spread from the bloodstream from somewhere else.
Right. It can be hematogenous.
So why is this considered a big bad? I mean, infections happen all the time. We treat them with antibiotics.
Because bone is a really tricky tissue to treat. When bone gets infected, the inflammation raises the pressure inside the rigid bone channels, and that can cut off the blood flow to the bone tissue itself.
Just like compartment syndrome, but on a micro level inside the bone?
It's a very similar concept. Mm-hmm. And if the bone tissue dies, it creates something called a sequestrum, which is basically a piece of dead bone. Antibiotics have a very hard time penetrating dead bone because there's no blood supply to carry the drug there.
So it becomes this little fortress for bacteria to hide in?
Exactly. It is notoriously difficult to cure. What you're looking for in your assessment are those systemic signs of infection. A high fever, usually over 101 degrees Fahrenheit, or 38.3 Celsius, tachycardia. The patient just looks and feels really sick.
And what about locally, at the site of the fracture or wound?
You'll see pain that's constant. It's often described as pulsating, and it gets worse with movement. The area itself might be really tender, swollen, and red.
And what about labs? The NCLEX loves to give you lab values.
For sure. You're going to see leukocytosis. That's an elevated white blood cell count.
Yep.
And you're almost certainly going to see an elevated ESR.
ESR, the erythrocyte sedimentation rate. We usually just call it the SED rate.
Right. The SED rate is a non-specific marker for inflammation. If it's high, it just tells us there's significant inflammation happening somewhere in the body. In this context, it points strongly toward that bone infection.
And the treatment for this isn't just a week of pills like you'd get for a sinus infection.
Not at all. It requires aggressive, long-term IV antibiotic therapy. We're talking 4 to 6 weeks, sometimes even months, of IV antibiotics.
So these patients are often going home with a PICC line or a central line.
Yep. They need home health care. It's a major, major life disruption.
Okay, so that covers the really life-threatening and limb-threatening complications. Those are the things you absolutely cannot miss. Now, let's shift gears to the equipment we use to fix these bones. I want to talk about traction and cast care.
Okay.
I feel like traction is one of those things that just looks like a medieval torture device to nursing students.
It definitely looks intimidating when you first walk into the room and see all the ropes and pulleys and weights hanging off the bed. But the principles behind it are actually very simple physics.
Right.
Traction is just a pulling force. It's applied in two directions to reduce and immobilize a fracture.
And reduce means to realign the bone, right?
Yes. It pulls the bone fragments back into their proper place. And this is key for patient comfort. It reduces those painful muscle spasms.
Right.
When a bone breaks, the muscles around it freak out and they spasm, which hurts like crazy and pulls the bone further out of alignment. Traction basically tires the muscle out and keeps it straight.
We need to distinguish between the two main types here, skin traction and skeletal traction. Let's start with skin traction and specifically Buck's traction.
Buck's traction is very, very common, especially for hip fractures. Mm. So picture an older patient who falls in their kitchen, breaks their hip. They get admitted to the hospital, but they can't go to surgery until the next morning.
Okay, so they're waiting for the OR.
They're waiting.
Okay.
And while they wait, the muscles around that broken hip are going to spasm uncontrollably. So we apply Buck's traction to keep them comfortable and keep the leg aligned.
And does this involve any kind of surgery or pins?
No. That's why it's called skin traction. It involves a special Velcro boot or maybe a foam boot that's applied to the lower leg. A rope is attached to that boot. It goes over a pulley at the end of the bed, and it hangs with a weight on it.
So there are no pins that go into the body at all. It's just pulling on the skin to pull on the leg.
Correct. And because it's pulling on the skin, the weight has to be much lighter, usually around 5 to 10 pounds. It's a temporary measure. It's all about buying time and comfort before the operation.
And because it's on the skin, what's our major safety check?
Skin integrity. You have to imagine wearing a tight boot that's being pulled on constantly for 24 hours. You have to take that boot off periodically, usually with a second nurse supporting the leg, to check for any breakdown, especially on the heel or the Achilles tendon.
Good point. Now, compare that to skeletal traction.
The skeletal traction is the heavy-duty stuff. This is where the surgeon actually inserts pins or wires or tongs directly through the skin and into the bone itself.
Wow.
This is for long-term immobilization or for really complex fractures that need a lot of force to pull them back into alignment.
So we literally have pieces of metal sticking out of the patient's leg.
Yes. And because the force is being applied directly to the bone, we can use much heavier weights. We're talking 15 to 30 pounds, sometimes even more.
And because there's a piece of metal going through the skin directly into the bone, what is the huge risk that we're worried about?
Infection, which can lead directly to that osteomyelitis we just talked about. So pin care is a massive nursing responsibility.
Now, here is a really common question I see. I see drainage at the pin site. What do I do?
Context is everything here. If you see a small amount of clear cerecerus, which is like watery drainage, or even some slightly crusty drainage around the pin, that is actually a normal finding.
Really?
Yes. The body's just reacting to this foreign object. You don't need to panic. You just document it and clean it according to your policy.
But if you see drainage that's thick, yellow, green, or if it smells bad?
That's purulent. That's pus. That, combined with any redness, heat, or increased pain at the site, means infection. That you report to the HCP immediately.
And for cleaning the pins, what's the general standard?
The NCLEX standard is usually sterile normal saline or potentially chlorhexidine, but you always follow your specific agency policy. The key concept is to keep it clean and prevent bacteria from traveling down that pin tract into the bone.
Now, regardless of whether we're talking about books or skeletal traction, there is one golden rule that applies to the weights. I feel like this shows up on every single exam.
It does. The weights must hang freely. They should never, ever, ever touch the floor.
Why not?
If the weight is resting on the floor, there is zero traction happening. The tension on that rope is gone. The muscle will immediately spasm, and the bone will shift out of alignment.
And as the nurse, should we ever be lifting the weights? Like, let's say we need to boost the patient up in bed because they've slid down. Do we just lift the weights to make it easier to move them?
No. Absolutely, never lift the weights. If you lift the weight, you release that traction force. That sudden release acts like a rubber band snapping back. The muscle will spasm violently, which is incredibly painful for the patient and can misalign the healing bone.
So how do we boost them up in bed then?
You get help. You need to have someone stabilize the limb while others move the patient, all while maintaining that continuous line of pull. But you do not manually lift those weights unless there's a life-threatening emergency or a very specific order to do so.
So keep them hanging free. Check the ropes for any fraying. Make sure the pulleys aren't getting blocked by the bed sheets or the blanket.
Correct. It is all about maintaining that continuous, smooth, uninterrupted line of pull.
Let's pivot now to cast care. We talked about the cast a bit in our intro scenario, but there is definitely more to it. Let's talk about the drying process first.
Yes. Most casts you'll see today are made of fiberglass, which dries really fast. Mm-hmm. But you might still see the old school plaster of Paris casts. And plaster takes a long time to dry, sometimes 24 to 48 hours.
And while it's wet, it's pliable, right? It's like wet clay.
Exactly. Which means how you handle it is critical.
So how do we handle it?
If you grab a wet plaster cast with your fingertips, you're going to leave indentations. You might not see them from the outside, but those indentations push inward toward the skin.
Like poking a finger into dough.
Right. And those little indentations on the inside of the cast become pressure points on the patient's skin. Over 24 hours, that constant pressure point will dig a hole into the skin and cause a pressure ulcer.
So the rule is, always handle a wet cast with the palms of your hands. Keep your hands flat.
Always use your palms.
Now what about drying? Can we, like, use a hairdryer to speed up the process?
No heat.
Yeah.
Absolutely no heat. Plaster sets by a chemical reaction that releases its own heat naturally. If you add a blow dryer, you can actually burn the skin underneath the cast.
Wow.
Or you can cause the outside to dry really fast while the inside stays wet, which leads to cracking and an unstable cast.
Yeah.
You have to let it air dry. You can use a fan for air circulation, but no heat settings.
There's another term I see in the source material, hot spot. If a patient points to a specific spot on their cast and says, it feels really hot right there, or if you run your hand over the cast and you feel a spot of heat radiating through, what does that mean?
Heat almost always means infection. Think about a pimple or an abscess. It feels hot to the touch. If there's a pressure ulcer or a wound underneath that cast that's getting infected, the metabolic activity of the bacteria creates heat. Since you can't see the skin, that heat is your clue.
And the smell, too.
Yes. If you smell a foul, musty, rotting odor coming from the ends of the cast, that is a sign of infection. You can't see it, but your nose and your sense of touch can tell you the truth. Do not ignore it. You have to notify the HCP. They might need to cut a window in the cast to check the skin underneath.
Okay, moving on down the body. Let's talk about hips. Hip fractures and hip replacements. This is a massive topic, especially for the geriatric population.
It is huge. Falls are a leading cause of morbidity and mortality in the elderly. And recognizing a hip fracture is a classic assessment skill.
Yeah.
If an older patient falls and breaks their hip, the leg on the affected side will usually present with two very distinct signs.
Shortening and external rotation.
Exactly. The powerful muscles of the leg pull the broken bone fragments up, which makes the leg look shorter than the other one. And then gravity and muscle tension cause the leg to turn outward, which is external rotation.
So if you see an elderly person on the floor and their leg is shortened with the foot flopped out to the side, you should be thinking hip fracture.
It's a hip fracture until proven otherwise.
Now, let's fast forward. They've had the surgery. They have a shiny new hip joint, the total hip arthroplasty. The post-op care is all about safety. That new joint is really unstable until the muscles heal around it. So you have these strict hip precautions. What's on the do not list?
The entire goal here is to prevent dislocation. The new head of the femur can literally pop out of the new socket if you move it the wrong way. Rule number one, do not flex the hip more than 90 degrees.
Okay, what does that look like in real life?
It means they cannot bring their knees up towards their chest.
Yeah.
It also means they can't sit in a low chair, because that would make their knees higher than their hips. They can't bend over to tie their shoes. They can't sit on a standard low toilet seat.
So they're going to need a raised toilet seat and one of those reacher grabber tools to pick things up off the floor.
Exactly. If they bend past 90 degrees, the leverage can pop that new hip right out the back.
Ouch. Okay, what's rule number two?
No adduction. Adduction means adding to the midline, so crossing the legs. You never want the legs to cross over the midline of the body.
So no crossing your legs at the ankles or the knees while you're sitting.
Correct. When you cross your legs, you put a twisting strain on that joint capsule. So if we're turning the patient in bed, we need to keep their legs apart. We use an abduction wedge, which is a big triangular foam pillow that we place between their knees.
And generally, we don't turn them to lie on the operative side right after surgery, do we?
Right. You don't want to put the full weight of the body on that fresh incision in that new joint.
The discharge teaching for this is huge. You have to be really explicit. Don't bend over to feed the dog. Don't cross your legs when you're watching TV.
Don't drive until you're cleared by the surgeon. It's a pretty significant lifestyle change for about 3 to 4 months.
Let's go from hip replacements to something even more drastic. Amputations. This is a heavy topic, both physically and psychologically for the patient.
Absolutely. With amputations, specifically lower extremity amputations, like an above knee or below knee, we have two main physiological concerns right off the bat. Hemorrhage and contractures.
Let's start with the immediate post-op period. Hemorrhage.
You have to remember, a major artery has been severed and either cauterized or tied off. If that ligature slips or if the patient moves the wrong way, they can bleed out in minutes. We're talking about a massive arterial bleed.
So safety rule number one is?
Keep a surgical tourniquet at the bedside, not in the drawer, not down the hall, right there at the bedside. If you see bright red blood soaking through the dressing, you apply that tourniquet high and tight and you call for help.
Okay. Now, positioning. This is where it gets tricky because the rules actually change after the first 24 hours, and the NCLEX loves to trap students on this.
Yes, they do. Here's the timeline you need to remember. For the first 24 hours, the stump, or the residual limb, is going to be very swollen. So it is acceptable to elevate the foot of the bed to help reduce that edema.
And notice you said elevate the foot of the bed, not just putting the limb on a pillow.
That's a key distinction. We raise the whole mattress. We generally avoid putting the limb on a soft pillow because a pillow allows the hip to flex and bend.
Okay, so elevate the foot of the bed for the first 24 hours to help with swelling. But what happens after 24
hours? After 24 hours, do not elevate. This is critical. If you keep that stump elevated on pillows, the hip joint stays in a flexed or bent position. The muscles on the front of the hip shorten, and the patient develops a hip flexion contracture.
And if they have a contracture, that means the leg's permanently stuck in a bent position.
Exactly. And if the hip is stuck bent, they cannot fit properly into a prosthetic leg. They will not be able to walk. They will be wheelchair bound. So after 24 hours, that bed must be flat.
And to actively prevent that contracture, we do something called prone positioning.
Yes. We have the patient lie on their stomach prone for about 20 to 30 minutes, 3 or 4 times a day.
Why does lying on your stomach help?
Think about the geometry of it.
Yeah.
When you lie on your stomach, your hips are forced into extension. or a straight position. It actively stretches that hip flexor muscle out. It counteracts all the time they spend sitting in a chair or in bed.
It's probably uncomfortable for them, but it's absolutely necessary for their future mobility.
It is. Tummy time is crucial for amputees.
What about phantom limb pain? Is that something that's just in their head?
It is in their head in the sense that the brain is processing this signal. But it is real pain. The nerve endings at the amputation site were severed, and they're misfiring.
Okay.
They might feel cramping, burning, or a crushing sensation in the foot that isn't even there anymore. Do not dismiss it. Do not tell the patient it's not real. You treat it with medication, often nerve pain meds like gabapentin or even opioids if it's severe.
Before we leave amputations, there's a specific critical thinking scenario in the source material about a traumatic amputation. Let's say you're a nurse at a factory, or even just a bystander, and a worker cuts their finger clean off with a saw. What do you do with the finger?
This is a classic first aid question. Your goal is to preserve the tissue for potential reattachment. Step one, apply direct pressure to the bleeding stump on the person's hand.
Stop the bleeding first.
Stop the bleeding. Step two, wrap the severed finger in dry, sterile gauze if you have it, or just a clean cloth if you don't. Step three, put that wrapped finger into a watertight sealed plastic bag.
And step four,
place that sealed bag into ice water. A slurry of ice and water is best.
And the key there is bag, then water. You never put the finger directly on the ice, right?
Never. Direct contact with ice will cause frostbite and tissue death. It essentially burns the tissue. And you don't put it directly in water either, because the tissue will get waterlogged and mushy. So remember, finger in a bag, bag in ice water, keep it cool but dry.
Perfect. Let's move on to the chronic conditions. We're talking about the big three arthritis types: rheumatoid arthritis, RA, osteoarthritis, OA, and gout. They all cause joint pain, but the underlying stories are very, very different.
Let's start by comparing RA and OA first. This is a classic compare and contrast for the ANCLEX.
Okay.
Rheumatoid arthritis, or RA, is an autoimmune disease. It's systemic. The body's own immune system is attacking itself, specifically the synovial membrane inside the joints.
And because it's systemic, you see other signs like fever, fatigue, anemia, right? It's not just the joints.
The patient feels sick all over, and the joint involvement is characteristically symmetrical. If their right wrist hurts, their left wrist usually hurts too. It affects both sides of the body.
What about the famous morning stiffness?
In RA, the morning stiffness is severe, and it lasts for a long time, usually longer than 30 minutes. It can take them an hour or more to loosen up. But here's the key concept. The pain and stiffness often decrease with use. Once they get up and get moving, the joints tend to loosen up and feel better.
So motion is lotion for RA?
To a certain extent, yes. But here's an important safety caveat. During a severe flare-up, when a joint is acutely inflamed, we actually want to rest that joint to prevent further damage. We might even use splints.
Okay.
You don't want to overwork a fiercely inflamed joint. But for general day-to-day stiffness, activity helps.
And the medications for RA?
Since it's an autoimmune issue, we use the heavy hitters. DARNs, disease-modifying antirheumatic drugs.
Yeah.
Methotrexate is the big one. Also the biologicals like etanercept. These drugs all suppress the immune system.
Which means that infection is a huge risk for any RA patient on these medications.
Correct. You have to monitor their white blood cell count and be vigilant for any signs of infection, like a fever.
Now let's contrast all of that with osteoarthritis, or OA.
OA is not autoimmune at all. It's wear and tear. It's a degenerative joint disease, or DJD. The cartilage that cushions the ends of the bones just wears down over time. It becomes bone on bone.
So who typically gets OA?
It's more common in older adults, people with obesity because there's more weight on the joints, and people with previous joint injuries, like an old football knee injury that comes back to haunt them.
And it's often asymmetrical, right?
Yes. Just the right knee might be bad because that's the one they injured years ago. It doesn't have that bilateral pattern like RA.
And the pain pattern for OA?
It's the opposite of RA. In OA, pain increases with activity. The more you use the joint, the more it grinds and hurts. It feels better with rest.
So, quick summary. RA has morning stiffness for more than 30 minutes and improves with motion. OA has pain that worsens with motion and improves with rest.
You got it. And physically, with OA, you might hear or feel crepitus, that grating, crunching sound in the joint. And on the hands, you look for specific nodes: Heberden's nodes on the distal joints by the fingertips, and Bouchard's nodes on the middle joints.
Okay, now what about the third one, gout?
Gout is a total different beast. It's a metabolic issue. It's caused by a buildup of uric acid in the blood. This uric acid can precipitate out and form these sharp, needle-like crystals that get deposited in the joints.
Ouch! Needles in the joints sounds awful!
It is described as excruciating pain. It often hits the big toe first, for some reason. And over time, you might see tophi, which are these hard, white, or yellowish nodules under the skin that are filled with uric acid crystals.
And I remember reading that gout can also cause kidney stones.
Yes, uric acid stones, which is why hydration is a massive nursing intervention for these patients. They need to be drinking 2 to 3 liters of fluid a day to help flush those kidneys and prevent stones from forming.
Let's talk about diet, the low purine diet. This is a classic patient teaching question. What foods are off limits?
Purines are compounds found in certain foods that our bodies break down into uric acid. The mnemonic I've heard is the rich man's diet. You want to avoid organ meats, things like liver, kidneys, sweetbreads.
Oh.
Also aged cheeses, wine, and certain fish like sardines and anchovies.
So no liver and onions for the patient with gout?
Definitely not. Liver is extremely high in purines.
And the medications for gout?
Allopurinol is the main maintenance medication. It's used to lower uric acid levels over the long term to prevent attacks. Colchicine is used for the acute attack itself to help with the inflammation and pain.
So a helpful way to remember is allopurinol prevents, colchicine treats the crisis.
That's a great way to think about it.
All right. We have covered a ton of ground. I want to briefly touch on diagnostics and mobility aids before we hit our checkpoint questions.
Yeah.
Let's talk crutches and canes. This is pure safety and mechanics.
For crutches, the fit is absolutely critical. There should be a gap of 2 to 3 finger widths between the patient's axilla, their armpit, and the top of the crutch pad.
Why is that gap so important? Why not just shove the crutch right up in the armpit for better support?
Because there's a major nerve complex that runs through there, the brachial plexus. If the patient rests their full body weight on their axilla, they can crush those nerves.
And that can lead to...
It can lead to a temporary or even permanent paralysis of the arms. It's a condition called crutch palsy.
So the weight should be carried where, then?
By the hands and the arms. The elbow should be flexed at about a 30-degree angle. The armpit should be completely free of pressure.
And what about for canes?
The cane always goes on the unaffected side, the strong side.
I always remember the mnemonic coeal cane opposite affected leg.
That's the one. And it makes sense if you think about it. If your left leg is weak, you put the cane in your right hand. As you step forward with the left weak leg, you lean on the right side, the cane, it creates a wider, more stable base of support, and it mimics your natural arm swing when you walk.
So you move the cane, then the weak leg, then the strong leg, or you can move the cane and the weak leg together.
Exactly.
And just quickly, on diagnostics, MRI and bone scans.
For an MRI, that's a magnetic resonance imaging scan.
Mm.
The magnet in that machine is incredibly powerful. The number one safety priority is no metal. You have to screen the patient for any metal implants. Pacemakers, aneurysm clips, shrapnel, cochlear implants.
And for a bone scan?
A bone scan involves injecting a radioisotope tracer. It's used to find hot spots in the bone, like infections or tumors. The big teaching point here is to have the patient drink a lot of fluids and then void, or pee, immediately after the procedure to clear that radioactive isotope out of their bladder.
Excellent. Okay, that was a high-yield breakdown. We went deep on the why and the how. Now, I want to test our listeners. We are going to do our rapid-fire checkpoints.
Let's do it.
I'm going to ask a question. I'll give a brief pause for you to think of the answer, and then our expert will break it down for us.
Let's see what you've learned.
Question one. You are caring for a patient who is in skeletal traction for a femur fracture. While you're doing your pin site care, you notice a small amount of clear, watery fluid weeping from one of the pin insertion sites. There is no redness or foul odor. What is your priority action? Brief pause.
The answer is, document the finding and continue with your care. The rationale here is that this is a normal finding. A small amount of clear or serious grainage is just the body's natural reaction to the pin. If it were yellow, thick, or purulent, or if the skin was red and hot, then you'd suspect infection. But clear is okay. You don't need to call the doctor for a normal finding.
Question two. A patient with a new fiberglass cast on their arm calls you into the room. They point to a specific spot on the cast and say, "It feels like a burning hot coal is pressing on my skin right there." You also notice a musty, unpleasant smell coming from the cast. What do you suspect, and what should you do? Brief pause.
You should suspect a pressure ulcer or an infection under the cast. Your priority action is to notify the healthcare provider. The rationale is that the hot spot, that burning pain plus palpable heat combined with a foul odor, is the classic sign of tissue necrosis or infection that's hidden from your view.
Yeah.
Do not stick anything down the cast to scratch it. The provider needs to be notified so they can remove or window the cast.
Question 3. You have two patients on your floor. Patient A has a fracture of the big toe. Patient B has a fracture of the shaft of the femur. Which one of these patients is at a higher risk for developing a fat embolism? Brief pause.
The answer is patient B, the one with the femur fracture. The rationale is that fat embolism syndrome is most commonly associated with fractures of the long bones, like the femur or humerus, and also pelvic fractures. This is because the yellow marrow in these bones has a very high fat content. And remember to look for that classic sign of petechiae on the chest.
Question 4. You were visiting a patient at home who had a below-the-knee amputation, or a BKA, 3 days ago. You find them lying in bed with their residual limb elevated on two high pillows. They tell you it just feels more comfortable that way. Do you allow this? Brief pause.
The answer is no. You need to educate them to remove the pillows. The rationale is that after the first 24 hours post-op, elevation is contraindicated because it promotes the development of hip flexion contractures. We need that hip to be able to extend fully, to be straight, so they can walk with a prosthesis later. You should encourage them to lie prone on their stomach instead to help stretch that hip.
Question 5. You are providing dietary discharge teaching to a client who has a new diagnosis of gout. You present them with a sample menu. Which one of these items must they remove? A spinach salad or fried liver and onions? Brief pause.
They must remove the liver. The rationale is that organ meats, like liver, are extremely high in purines, which metabolize in the body to form uric acid. This will trigger a painful gout attack. Spinach is generally okay. The main things to avoid are organ meats, alcohol, and dehydration.
How did you do? If you got 5 out of 5, you are absolutely crushing it. If you missed a few, don't worry. That's exactly why we're doing this.
Absolutely. Repetition is key. These core concepts, safety, infection, circulation, they repeat over and over again on the exam because they're the things that matter most in real-life nursing practice.
Let's bring it all home with a quick recap. What are the top 5 takeaways from this entire deep dive?
Takeaway number 1, know your complications. Pain out of proportion equals compartment syndrome. Chest petechiae plus confusion equals fat embolism. You have to know the difference.
Takeaway number 2, traction safety. The weights must hang free. Never lift them without an order. It's just physics. Don't mess with the physics or you're going to hurt the patient.
Takeaway number 3, hip precautions. Don't break that 90-degree rule. No bending, no crossing the legs, which is adduction. You have to protect that new joint from dislocating.
Takeaway number 4, know the difference between RA and OA. RA is autoimmune and symmetrical. OA is wear and tear and asymmetrical. Their pain patterns are opposites.
And takeaway number 5, crutches protect the nerves. Keep that 2 to 3 finger gap in the axilla to prevent that brachial plexus injury and arm paralysis.
You know, musculoskeletal questions can be so tricky because they often look like they're comfort questions, like, oh, the patient is in pain, I should give them more pain meds. But really, deep down, they're safety questions.
That is the aha moment. Is this pain just pain? Or is this pain a sign of ischemia? If you can approach every musculoskeletal question with that lens of, is the blood flowing? Is the nerve working? You are going to pass this section.
And remember, if you're feeling overwhelmed by the sheer amount of information, the angles, the labs, the meds, that is totally normal. You are learning a whole new language, but you're doing it.
Just take it one concept at a time. Master these core safety rules, and the rest will start to fall into place.
And for more tools to help make all of this stick, check out nursingnotes.org. We've got those music-based learning tools because sometimes a song gets stuck in your head way better than a textbook chapter, and our AI helpers are there to quiz you just like we did today.
It's a great way to lock in the knowledge and build that confidence.
This has been ConceptCast. Keep studying, stay curious, and go crush that NCLEX.
You've got this.
See you next time.